Davis, An Autobiography, and Abolition Feminism Now. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website, at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Wheeler faces legal challenge over 2020 curfew. Newburgh School Board beats recall election. And in international news, Saudi airstrike kills 20 in Yemen. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 19, 2021. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Proud Boy and Patriot prayer provocateur Tusitila Tiny Tosi was arrested and jailed in Washington State on 11 charges related to last summer's political violence. The far-right brawler was a recognizable figure at Portland protests. Tosi was an outspoken supporter of violence against trans people and often attended protests with weapons including baseball bats and paintball guns. Tosi currently faces 11 charges related to last August's ironically titled Summer of Love event, where Proud Boys fought counter-protesters in an abandoned Kmart parking lot in Portland's Park Rose neighborhood with no police intervention. The charges include 3 counts of second-degree assault, a weapons charge, several accounts of criminal mischief, third-degree assault, obstructing an officer, and trespassing. The Oregonian reports that a source familiar with the investigation says Tosi is accused of using a baseball bat to smash the windows of a van and directing others to attack a man inside. Tosi is a Vancouver resident and must be extradited to Multnomah County to face trial for his felony charges. That may take some time, however, since Tosi is facing charges in Thurston County and will likely have to be tried there before coming to Multnomah County. Attorney Juan Chavez represents 2 of the victims of violence perpetrated by Proud Boys on August 22nd. Chavez told Oregon Live, quote, "Right-wing organizing in our city can't continue unabated. These indictments sent a strong message. My hope is that the Proud Boys will think twice about coming to Portland to terrorize our communities." A Portland Police Bureau training advocated violence against protesters during 2018. With more, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
On Friday, Portland City Government released a PowerPoint slide from a 2018 police training that joked about beating protesters. New court statements from a lawsuit brought by Don't Shoot Portland alleged the presentation was shown as training to Portland police, Multnomah County sheriffs, Salem Police, and Oregon State Police. The slide contained a meme referring to demonstrators as dirty hippies and advocated leaving them cuffed and stuffed, stitched and bandaged. On Monday, lawyers from the U.S. Department of Justice told the police chief and city attorneys to hand over training materials for the Bureau's Rapid Response Team, the official name of the police force's now-defunct riot squad. The city had tried to keep the presentation from the public. By obscuring the training, the city of Portland violated an 8-year-old use of force settlement with the Department of Justice. Portland City Attorney Robert Taylor defended the city's decision to withhold the presentation, saying, quote, "The training presentation was evidence in an ongoing internal affairs investigation, and before disclosing the information, the city hoped to complete the necessary fact-gathering," end quote. On Friday, Mayor Ted Wheeler said he was disgusted that this offensive content was included in a training presentation for officers. City Commissioner Dan Ryan called the meme reprehensible. According to a Justice Department report, Portland police used force more than 6,000 times against protesters from May 29, 2020 to November 15, 2021. Reporting by Dan Raphael for KBOO News.
A Multnomah County defense attorney may bring Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler to court over his curfew order from summer 2020. Lawyer Emma McDermott defends Tommy Pack, a 23-year-old who was arrested for a curfew violation while walking to his car with his girlfriend. Police found a loaded firearm on Pack and subsequently charged him with an additional 2 charges. McDermott says her client's arrest and Wheeler's executive order as a whole were unconstitutional. The case centers on the question, what authority does the mayor have to limit protests and demonstrations? Central to her argument is an executive order from the mayor's office, which delegated police the authority to arrest anyone deemed in violation of the curfew. McDermott claims such an order is outside the authority of the mayor's office, using an extra-legal mandate to restrict political speech. City officials defend the mayor's decision as a necessary measure in the face of an emergency. Tommy Pack's case began yesterday, and the mayor may be called to testify. Students at Grant High School in Portland walked out yesterday in protest of what they consider inadequate COVID-19 prevention measures. Among their demands were easier access to N95 masks, better contact tracing, and clearer communication. Students are the latest group to butt heads with district administrators. Portland Public Schools dismissed a letter from school nurses last weekend accusing the district of failing to take proper steps to prevent the spread of COVID. Negotiations between public school teachers and the district over long hours and poor accommodations have also stalled. Student attendance and staffing have reached historic lows while area schools struggle to keep up with the needs of their communities. 2 Newburgh school board members behind the district's decision to ban Pride and Black Lives Matter symbols from schools are poised to keep their jobs by a narrow margin in yesterday's recall election. Board Chair Dave Brown and Vice Chair Brian Shannon were at the center of high-profile scandals last year when the two voted to ban Black Lives Matter and Pride symbols in Newburgh public schools. The petition to recall Brown and Shannon began in November, days after the two voted to fire the popular District Superintendent Joe Morlock without cause. Morlock refused to implement the ban the school board has passed, since the district's legal counsel said it would be unconstitutional. Brown and Shannon represent the 4-person conservative majority of the 7-member school board court. Their effort to ban Black Lives Matter and Pride symbols coincided with several racist incidents in September, including a teacher coming to school in blackface and a mock slave auction held by white students on Snapchat. The school board's decision to ban these symbols has been condemned by most students and faculty at Newburgh schools, who say it violates the state's All Students Belong policy. School board meetings were previously not well attended, but since the conservative majority began pushing for the ban, virtual meetings have had increased attendance. Voters turned out in high numbers for a school board election, and votes are still being counted.
The U.S. Senate has begun debating voting legislation that almost certainly will not pass without changing their filibuster rules. The Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act makes Election Day a national holiday, ensures access to early voting and mail-in ballots, and allows the Justice Department to intervene in states with a prior history of racist voting interference. Senate Republicans unanimously opposed the Democratic voting legislation agenda, viewing it as federal overreach. passage would create national election standards that supersede state-level laws, including things like requiring photo ID to vote. The Republicans have blocked voting legislation at least 5 times in recent months through the filibuster mechanism. The filibuster is not in the Constitution, but has been used since the early 1800s to block legislation disliked by a sizable minority party in the Senate. The Senate has few rules limiting speech duration by its members. Senator Strom Thurmond stood continuously and spoke against the 1957 Civil Rights Act for 24 hours and 18 minutes. The Senate did originally have rules allowing for long debates to be cut off, but that provision was eliminated more than 200 years ago. Now, the Senate requires 60 votes to end a filibuster. One way around the filibuster is the so-called nuclear option. A simple majority of 51 votes can be used to change Senate rules regarding the filibuster. Right now, 2 conservative Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, oppose invoking that option, despite supporting the voting legislation itself. They argue Congress should try harder for acceptable bipartisan solutions. The opposing senators have been criticized by black leaders and civil rights organizations. Members of their party have threatened to withdraw campaign support. Ironically, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who led his party in eliminating the filibuster 60-vote threshold in nominating Trump Supreme Court nominees, warned against changing the rules again. He said doing away with the filibuster regulations would, quote, break the Senate, end quote. Formerly reluctant himself to change Senate rules, President Biden has pressured senators to do so now. Many see his effort is coming too late. Biden recently told reporters, quote, the honest-to-God answer is I don't know whether we can get this done, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
With more on the Senate bill and other stories from the Capitol, here's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
The eyes of the nation will be watching what happens this week in the United States Senate.
Debate continued Tuesday on Capitol Hill over the future of voting rights, even as the package appears dead on arrival. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer accused Republicans, who have voted several times to keep the bills off the floor, of blocking a formal debate on the legislation. By combining the two separate bills into an unrelated measure, the Democratic leader was able to bypass that roadblock and bring the package before the Senate.
When this chamber confronts a question this important, one so vital to our country, so vital to our ideals, so vital to the future of our democracy, you don't slide it off the table and say, never mind.
Democrats still haven't secured the necessary 60 votes to overcome a final filibuster and are weighing options to clear that hurdle. The Senate will end the debate, kicking off a final vote on the package and setting up a filibuster showdown this week. The Biden administration is highlighting plans to allocate $27 billion in federal funds to replace and repair America's bridges. The initiative is being funded via the bipartisan infrastructure law and seeks to repair more than 15,000 bridges across the country. The project is being coordinated by Mitch Landrieu, the former New Orleans mayor who oversaw the final stages of the city's recovery after Hurricane Katrina.
This infrastructure work in general is not a one-time economic stimulus. It is not a race to see how many ribbons we can cut before the end of the year. Doing this is going to require balance. It's going to require order. We are definitely going to go fast, but we are not going to hurry, and we are going to get it right.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is traveling to Europe and Ukraine this week in an effort to reinvigorate talks between Russia and Western allies. The discussions come as Russian troops have been amassing along the Ukrainian border in recent months. In a conversation with the Washington Post on Tuesday, America's UN ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said Blinken's trip was in response to recent moves by the Russians to bolster their presence along the border.
And any actions that we've seen that the Russians have taken that may indicate that they're moving forward will cause us to ramp up our efforts as well in terms of our engagements with our partners.
Finally today, a federal appeals court has passed along a challenge to Texas's abortion ban to the state's Supreme Court. Politico reports that reproductive rights groups wanted the issue sent back to a lower court, which previously blocked the law. The appeals court's decision will prolong litigation over the ban, which means the law will be left in place for now. The policy bans most abortions after 6 weeks and allows private citizens to sue abortion providers who violate the law. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
KBU News poet Dan Raphael won't play the blame game.
The blame game is insane, but it's what most media are playing. The New Yorker magazine on NPR listed Biden's failures without mentioning Republican obstruction. Just as the Republicans blame Biden for the inflation caused by Trump and the tax cuts and defense spending the Repubs voted for. Media says Biden failed to stop COVID because he didn't provide tests. And what does a test do but help you figure out who to blame for getting sick? While few in the media blame Big Pharma for its greed or the unvaxxed for filling all the ICU beds. Some say Governor Brown failed stopping COVID because she made too many restrictions, while others say she didn't restrict us long enough. And who's to blame for homelessness, for high rents? Our local leaders don't want to talk about it or take any meaningful action against the root cause, capitalism. No one wins the blame game, which can only distract and discourage us from taking whatever small steps we can, helping neighbors and friends in need, even if it's just sharing a joke and a treat. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio reporting on why drinking water and industrial forests don't mix. Expect rain and temperatures in the 40s tonight, followed by clear, cool weather tomorrow. American Gothic poet Edgar Allan Poe was born 213 years ago today in Boston, Massachusetts. The quote of the day is from Poe: "I became insane with long intervals of horrible sanity."
A Florida public health official was put on administrative leave by the state health agency after encouraging staff to get vaccinated. Now, County Health Director Raul Pino is under investigation to determine whether he broke the law. In an email to staff members, Pino noted that less than half of state public health officials were fully vaccinated. Pino wrote, quote, "I have a hard time understanding how we can be in public health and not practice it," end quote. Right-wing Florida Governor Ron DeSantis banned state agencies, hospitals, and schools from issuing vaccine mandates. Reporting by Ethan Sandweiss for KBU News.
Disagreements and inconsistencies in masking requirements have reached the Supreme Court. Not in a case, though. Conservative Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch refuses to mask in court, prompting Justice Sonia Sotomayor to work remotely. Sotomayor is at increased risk for COVID because she has diabetes. After Chief Justice John Roberts requested the court to wear masks, every judge except Gorsuch complied. Gorsuch was nominated by former President Trump in 2017 to replace the late Antonin Scalia. His brash disregard for precedent has earned him ire from conservative and liberal colleagues alike. Gorsuch joined the conservative supermajority in a party-line decision last week to block Biden's vaccine mandate for large companies. In a response to an NPR story that Gorsuch ignored a request from Sotomayor to wear a mask in court, the two justices issued a joint statement rejecting the claim and affirming that they remain, quote, warm colleagues and friends. According to Supreme Court protocols, all lawyers and reporters must be tested and masked before entering the courtroom. Similar rules don't exist for the justices. Texas approaches the one-year anniversary of devastating winter storms that led to over 250 deaths. Observers are warning that little has been done by the state or utility companies to prevent another catastrophe. With more, here's Roz Brown.
Not enough has been done to prevent another catastrophic power grid failure like the one in Texas last February, according to AARP Texas. And the group warns consumers will foot the bill for what comes next. A rare winter storm left millions without power and 246 Texans dead, almost two-thirds over age 60. AARP's Tim Morstad estimates gas and electric customers will pay more than $6 billion in their utility bills to cover cleanup costs from Winter Storm Uri, with none designated for grid improvements. He adds changes proposed by regulators to revamp the electric market lack cost analysis and public input.
And ultimately, it comes down to the pocketbook, because while we all want and support a reliable electricity grid, we want to make sure we're getting what we pay for, and we want to make sure that the public's voice is heard.
While improvements may be needed and beneficial, Morstead says the initial price tag at $1.7 billion a year to be built into customers' utility bills is alarming. In Katy, Laura Taylor and her husband were prepared for rolling blackouts predicted by their utility company as they cared for their special needs daughter, who suffers seizures and requires breathing and suction machines. Instead, they spent 52 hours without power and had to recharge the machines from a car battery.
The trauma of the middle of the night and trying to literally keep her alive when all the hospitals were filled, all of the roads were icy, was just overwhelming.
Worried about a repeat of last year's storm, the Taylor family has purchased a whole house generator. Taylor says Texans shouldn't have to wait 10 years to make sure safeguards are in place.
It's just beyond me that we can't hold people's feet to the fire so that they have to invest to protect consumers. Every other state handles cold weather. Why can't we?
Morstead notes that older Texans and medically vulnerable people are particularly sensitive to power outage and utility price hikes, with many living on a fixed income.
The rub is that the proposals being pursued are very expensive, haven't been proven to solve the problem that has been identified, and the pocketbook's already been strained.
For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Saudi Arabia's ongoing war in Yemen claimed another 20 civilian lives yesterday with a joint Saudi-Emirati airstrike on the city of Sana'a against the home of Houthi rebel leaders. Saudi Arabia's entry into Yemen in 2015 heralded the world's worst humanitarian crisis, spurring mass starvation and over 130,000 reported deaths. Saudi Arabia purchases most of its military ordnance from the United States. Supply chain strain has made it difficult for governments to meet their citizens' needs, no less so for the Navajo Nation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Supply chain disruptions are impacting the Navajo Nation. Tribal leaders are asking citizens for their patience and to continue to shop on the reservation and not travel away for goods and services due to the surge of COVID-19. Last week, the retailer Bash's, the major grocery store chain on the Navajo Nation, wrote a letter to the tribe addressing supply chain shortages. Company leadership explained that all their stores, including on Navajo land in Arizona and New Mexico, are facing challenges with stocking, staffing issues at their distribution site in the Phoenix area, and manufacturing and vendor shortages. During a virtual town hall Tuesday, Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez briefly addressed supply shortages.
But it's happening all across the country where supermarkets are less. And we saw that here happen on Navajo, but the Bash's family and the new company has also restocked those shelves. And we appreciate that.
Nez urged people to utilize stores on the Navajo Nation to avoid bringing COVID-19 back to the reservation. Bash's leaders stated in the letter they're working around the clock to try to address supply disruptions and expressed a commitment to serve the Navajo people. The non-native retailer is urging for patience and understanding. Chairman Manuel Hart of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe is urging U.S. lawmakers to find ways to invest in infrastructure in Indian country to help close the digital divide. Hart took part in a virtual roundtable discussion last week on broadband infrastructure held by the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. Hart says the COVID-19 pandemic has shown the need for better internet, as tribes, especially in rural areas, rely on it for healthcare, education, law enforcement, and other needs. He says telehealth expansion is greatly needed and improvements for online learning. The tribe put up hotspots around the community for parents to drive their children to access the internet for school.
Our land base is 600,000 acres, but it goes down to two communities, one in Colorado and one in southeast Utah. So we have to try to find ways and dollars to get internet to each one of the homes. And we don't have that access right now. We do have some outside companies that do satellites, but those are unreliable. They get locked into a contract for 2 years. And with whatever service they provide, It's hard for them.
Hart says grants are not meeting the needs for broadband improvements. Senators on the Indian Affairs Committee pointed to investments made for broadband and COVID-19 relief bills and the infrastructure law. Lawmakers committed to seek tribal set-asides in future legislative efforts. The Departments of the Interior and Agriculture are hosting consultations with tribes and Alaska Natives this week on the Federal Subsistence Management Program. The program provides the opportunity for a subsistence way of life for hunting and fishing on federal lands and waters in Alaska. The consultations will include climate change, how the agencies can better cooperate with Alaska Native people, and state impacts on the program. The consultations will be held with tribes and Native organizations Thursday and Friday. Next week, consultations will be held with Alaska Native regional and village corporations. Meanwhile, the White House Council on Native American Affairs will host a session with tribal leaders on implementations of the infrastructure law. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland will lead the virtual session. The bipartisan infrastructure law invests more than $13 billion in tribal communities across the country. Priorities include replacing aging infrastructure, expanding access to clean drinking water, and improving access to high-speed internet. The session will also focus on President Biden's order on improving public safety and criminal justice for Native Americans and addressing missing and murdered Indigenous people. The session is scheduled to take place on January 31st. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Many school-age kids are learning remotely, and ophthalmologists from Indiana University are cautioning parents that prolonged screen time can cause strain on the eyes. With more on this story, here's Jonah Chester.
Excessive screen time can cause a host of negative side effects in kids, but as some Indiana schools go virtual because of the Omicron variant, prolonged interaction with technology can be unavoidable. Dr. Derek Sprunger with the Indiana University School of Medicine's Ophthalmology Department says parents can still use several methods to moderate their kids' screen time. He advises limiting kids' exposure to non-education-related technology.
I don't say eliminate, but cut back. And there's no exact amount of time that you should or shouldn't be doing this. But if you're doing a lot through school, more than typical, cut back on your outside of school time, like gaming and things like that.
Sprunger says excessive screen time can cause several short-term health effects, including eye fatigue, blurred vision, and headaches. According to the Mayo Clinic, it can also lead to irregular sleep and impaired academic performance. In addition to those side effects, Sprunger adds overusing technology can also advance long-term nearsightedness.
This is a more permanent thing. The things we talked about earlier, if you cut usage of your screen time, that will reverse. Once you induce nearsightedness, that can be a more permanent problem.
Dr. Scott Edmonds with United Healthcare recommends breaking up screen time to limit eye strain. He says for every 20 minutes folks spend staring at a computer, they should take 20 seconds to observe something at least 20 feet away.
That break takes you away from the blue light, lets your pupil go to its normal size, lets your muscles in your eye relax, lets your focusing muscle relax. All that every 20 minutes will really help you be more comfortable with screen time.
In a September report from the Pew Research Center, about 70% of parents said their children are spending more time in front of screens than they did pre-pandemic. For the Indiana News Service, I'm Jonah Chester.
Several airlines around the world, including British Airways, Emirates, and Air India, have canceled or changed U.S.-bound flights due to concerns about 5G mobile phone technology being installed near airports. The Federal Aviation Authority, or FAA, has said that 5G signals could interfere with radio altimeters, which measure how far the plane is from the ground. These gauges are particularly important when pilots are landing with low visibility, and having them go haywire could be detrimental. The airlines and FAA are not worried about individual users' cell phones, but the cell towers themselves. AT&T and Verizon said they would pause the rollout near key airports, which was planned to start today. Yesterday, the FAA began updating its guidance on which airports and aircraft models would be affected, focusing initially on the Boeing 777. Emirates, the world's largest operator of 777s, said that it would halt flights to 11 U.S. airports, including Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, and Seattle, because of 5G. Other airlines, including Lufthansa, Air Japan, and Air India, said they would use other types of planes for affected U.S. routes and canceled some flights. Mm-hmm. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 19, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Josh Salem. The producer is myself, Ethan Sandweiss, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Roz Brown, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Hey everybody, thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew, and we'd love to hear from those folks listening out there. Drop us a line or an email at andrew@coastrange.org, and we'll get back to you and really appreciate y'all listening. If you're listening in on your local community radio station, thanks for supporting those stations. They're valuable resources for communities across Western Oregon. Please support your local community station. So today we're talking about forests and water, and I'm excited to have Sam Kropp back in the co-host chair. And Sam is also very knowledgeable about this subject. She's the Coalition Coordinator for the Forest Waters Coalition.